Setlist in association with 7Digital.
This week, the 10 things people get wrong about streaming, part 2. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
This week, it's part 2 of our 2-part episode on the 10 things people get wrong about streaming. The 10 things you need to know if you want to argue for a fairer system of royalty distribution in the streaming market.
Yes, so assuming you were tuning in to last week's edition, you will remember that we noted how, although the various debates around how Spotify money and streaming money get shared out between artists and labels and songwriters and publishers and the services themselves, that debate's not new. That debate has been ongoing for years. Here at CMU, through the work we have done for the UK's Music Managers Forum, we have staged probably more digital pie debates than anyone else. But as we noted on last week's set list, this has become a much bigger conversation in recent weeks in the context of the COVID-19 shutdown, because many of those artists and songwriters who have seen some of their revenue streams pretty much stop overnight, so the live income stream, but also on the songwriter side, the studio work revenue stream. Plus, of course, although at the moment money from radio and public performance is still coming in, because that money takes quite a long time to go through the system, ultimately that revenue stream will also be hit. And with all those other revenue streams being on pause and on hold, it has put the spotlight back on, well, what happens to all the streaming money? Because the record industry keeps telling us how the streaming boom is ongoing, how the record industry is back into growth, how all this money is coming in. But there are plenty of artists, and especially songwriters, who don't feel that they are getting their fair share of that money. And that's annoying all the time, but it's all the more annoying when those other revenue streams are suddenly on pause. So what has been a debate for a number of years now has become a much more timely debate, which is why we thought we should dedicate 2 editions of Setlist to presenting some of the things that we think you need to know, some of the complexities of streaming that you need to understand in order to enter that debate in an informed fashion.
And it became even more newsworthy in the last 7 days because, not actually to coincide with the first episode of this series, although fortuitously it did, the Musicians Union and the Ivors Academy in the UK launched a campaign called Keep Music Alive, in which they called on the UK government to urgently undertake a review of streaming to ensure that the music ecosystem is transparent and fair. They are also demanding that all different strands of the music industry come together to discuss how streaming income is shared out every month.
Yeah, in some ways, the first of those 2 demands is the more interesting. The idea that government should be intervening, getting everyone around the table and forcing this debate to happen. That's a very interesting proposal. They didn't go into any great detail as to whether or not they just want government to facilitate this debate or whether they're suggesting that actually we should be somehow using copyright law to force the issue or to even address the issue, whether or not copyright law itself could be used to redistribute how the money gets shared out, to re-slice the digital pie. That's debatable. In some ways, it possibly could, but there are all sorts of complexities around that. I mean, even ignoring the fact that it can take years to get copyright law amended, but there are also other issues. For example, this is a global challenge for the music community, for the music industry. Copyright law still operates on a country-by-country basis, even though, for example, in the European Union, obviously there have been lots of efforts to harmonise copyright across the EU with mixed success. So even if in the UK you could find some way of amending copyright law to deal with some of this, almost certainly not all of it, but some of it, that still wouldn't fix the problem worldwide. Although, as I say, to date, MU and Ivors have not specifically said this is a problem for Parliament to address through changing copyright law. They're simply calling on the government to bring everybody together to force the debate and I suppose, to try and force some compromises to be reached in order to move this debate forward.
So launching the new Keep Music Alive campaign and an accompanying petition to go with it, the Ivors Academy and MU last week stated, COVID-19 has hit songwriters, musicians and composers hard. Gigs and commissions have been cancelled, festivals and performances postponed, and recording studios closed. This crisis has brought into sharp relief the fact that creators and performers are sustained primarily by income generated by the live side of the business, and that streaming royalties are woefully insufficient.
They then went on that the Keep Music Alive campaign aims to fix streaming, in quotes, and calls for industry stakeholders to come together to agree an equitable, sustainable, and transparent model for royalty distribution in the streaming era. And then they formally launched that petition that you mentioned, which is calling on government to urgently undertake a review of streaming to ensure that the music ecosystem is transparent and fair.
So there were specific statements for both organisations involved as well. So the Musicians Union's Deputy General Secretary, Naomi Pohl, said, "Musicians should not be so dependent on their income from gigging and music teaching that when it falls away, they are literally unable to pay their bills within weeks. The recorded music industry must play its part in shoring up the individuals on whose talent and creativity it so heavily relies. We have been asking for a fairer deal on streaming for years, and it is long overdue." Then the Ivors Academy's chair, Crispin Hunt, added, "Many in and outside the industry are not aware of the plight of most songwriters and composers. If people knew how little of the money they pay for music actually goes to the music creators, they would be shocked. Donations are essential at this time because the hardship is real. But why are songwriters and composers being given donations when others make billions on their creativity? We cannot go back to the old broken industry when the immediate crisis is over. It's time to create something that works for everyone."
So a very interesting development in the last 7 days on this whole digital pie debate. It will be interesting to see how other stakeholders in the music industry respond, and indeed how government responds. I mean, obviously, in the short term, most government ministers probably have got some other issues on their mind. But nevertheless, there is that petition aimed at the UK government, and so we will wait to see how they respond. But as we said on last week's set list, we do feel that whether you're an artist or a songwriter or a label or a publisher, or you're a government minister, you're welcome to tune in too to set list. We'll probably slag you off at some point, but you are welcome here. Or anyone else interested in this debate. The streaming business model is complex. The way money gets shared out is complex. The way royalties get processed each month is complex. And while we're not expecting every artist, every songwriter, everybody in the music community to become an expert on it all, it has to be said, you do need a basic understanding, really, of some of the specifics of how all of this works in order to enter this debate in an informed way. And there are some very common misunderstandings. Obviously, the people at the MU, the people at Ivors, some of the people who've been leading this debate on the social networks, they understand all of this. But the people who then join in the debate, there are some common misunderstandings. And so the purpose of these two editions of Setlist was to try and set some of those out so that everybody has the basic information they need to properly participate in this debate. We've broken it down into the 10 things that people commonly misunderstand or get wrong about streaming. So we did 5 last week, and now we're going to do the other 5. But probably we should just very quickly recap what we covered last week before we get going with the next 5. That would seem like a sensible thing to do.
Yes, we should. I mean, you should go back and listen to last week's episode, but I think let's recap now so that everyone's up to speed with where we're at this stage in the story. So number 1 was there are no per stream rates.
A really, really important point, because so many times on social networks, people get that rate card that does the rounds, that tells you that this is what you get every time a track is streamed on Spotify or Apple or whatever. And while it is true we can average out the money that comes in by the number of streams that occurred and get an average approximate per stream rate, there isn't a rate card. It's not as simple as that. And I think it's really important to always remember that whenever you're talking about streaming money. And we explained how it works on part 1. But you just need to remember there are actually no per stream rates.
Point number 2. A million streams isn't as much as it sounds.
That relates to this rate card that does the rounds, because whenever the rate card does the rounds, people then say, oh my God, if you had a million streams, you would only make this much money. That really doesn't sound like a lot of money for a million streams, because my God, a million streams is huge. But actually, we should always remember that, well, I'm not pretending that for an artist starting out, it is easy to get a million streams. It really isn't. But at the same time, billions and billions and billions of streams are being serviced every single day of the week. So everything in streaming is big numbers. So it's important to remember that actually a million streams isn't as much as it sounds. And for, you know, established artists, getting a million streams actually is quite easy to do.
Number 3, it is almost certainly time to review subscription prices for streaming services. though probably not in the middle of a global pandemic.
Yeah, so remember, streaming is ultimately a revenue share business, so the money that comes in through Spotify, Apple, etc. is shared out between the services, the labels, the artists, the songwriters, and the publishers. So it's all about revenue share. So obviously, if there was more revenue, then there would be more for everybody to share. And the most obvious way to get more revenue, well, getting more subscribers would be one way, and in some ways that has been the focus for the last 10 years, just getting more and more people signed up, preferably to paying services, because subscription money is always vastly more than advertising money. But the other way is to put the prices up, and that's an increasingly big debate in the music industry at the moment. Maybe it's time to put the prices up, given that they haven't gone up at all, really, since Spotify and Deezer first launched in the late 2000s. If anything, because of discounting and bundling and emerging markets, the price has gone down. So it does feel like it is time to start putting those prices up. But yeah, as we acknowledged last week, probably not in the middle of a COVID-19 pandemic where everybody is struggling for cash.
Number four, reslicing the pie so that songwriters get more money is complicated.
And in some ways, that reslicing of the pie to the benefit of songwriters is at the very heart of the most recent iteration of the digital pie debate, certainly from an Ivers Academy viewpoint. That's very much what they're pushing for. So remember, we talked last week about how these are all very much approximate figures, but approximately of the money that comes in, about 30% will stay with the streaming services. And of the 70% that goes into the music industry, a lot more will be allocated to the recording, shared by labels and artists, and to the song, shared by publishers and songwriters. So of all the money that comes in, 50 to 60% ends up with the record industry, 10 to 15% with the publishers and the songwriters. And there is an argument. I mean, last week we explained how we got to those splits, but there is an argument on the songwriter side that the songwriters should be getting significantly more in percentage terms. It's a good argument. There's plenty of reasons why you should support that, although there are some arguments on the other side as well. But there are also some complexities. It's not quite as simple as tomorrow the industry deciding, OK, we're going to increase the song share. And again, we talked about all of that on last week's edition.
And then our final point last week, point five, the US is different because the US is always different.
And that's in particular in relation to this reslicing of the pie to the songwriter's benefit. In America, compulsory licenses and the consent decrees that regulate collecting societies, BMI and ASCAP, interfere in a way that really the law shouldn't be interfering. And if it was up to me, we would get rid of the compulsory license. We would regulate the societies in a much different way. But it is worth being aware that sometimes, particularly when we talk about the split of the money that goes to the song and the songwriters, we have to treat the US separate to much of the rest of the world because of some whims with American copyright law.
So it's already quite a complicated system. And then the US, with its insistence on doing everything in a different way, just complicates things further. But that brings us up to where we got to last week. So now we move on to point six, which is that there has already been a reslicing of the pie, despite us just saying it was very complicated to do. And as a result, the song share in percentage terms is now often more than double on a stream what it would be on a CD. But the fact that many songwriters are still saying that they're not seeing the benefit of that is a major concern.
Yeah, it really is. If you think about it, of the money that's coming in, the percentage allocated to the song on a stream, as we've said several times, is probably at least double what it would have been on a CD. Meanwhile, the record industry has been back in growth for 5 years now. So the amount of money coming into the record industry, of which the songwriters and publishers share, has been going up for 5 years now. So in some ways, songwriters should be seeing a benefit of the fact that the record industry is back in growth and their share on the biggest revenue stream for the record industry is bigger, potentially twice plus what it was on a CD. So why are so many songwriters and managers of songwriters saying that streaming isn't working, that they're just not seeing the money coming in? That is worrying. Now, it could be that streaming is just a very different way of doing business to discs and downloads. So for example, when you used to sell an album with 10 tracks on it, therefore 10 songs on it, the money that came in for the publishers, the mechanical royalties as we called it, used to get split 10 ways to each of the tracks. Even if one of those tracks was a track that everybody used to skip and nobody really liked. Whereas in the streaming age, if you write track 7 that nobody listens to, you get no plays, therefore you account for zero consumption overall, so you don't get any money. So it might be that it's just because streaming is different to discs and downloads that there are, within the songwriter community, winners and losers. There are some songwriters for whom this really works, and there are some songwriters for whom this totally doesn't work. And maybe the winners are staying quiet and the losers are shouting about it. That's one possible explanation. There's also things like the fact that, you know, hit records these days have many more co-writers. And remember, you know, that 15% that's coming in on the song side has to be shared out between those co-writers. And if there are 10 of them, that's a lot of ways that that money has to be sliced. So that may be another issue. However, there is one thing that it's really important for songwriters and the publishers they work with to be aware of, which brings us to the Dissecting the Digital Dollar project that CMU has been working on with the Music Managers Forum for the last 5 years. And it's because of that project and all of the things that MMF have done and all the things that we at CMU have done with them, that's why we have all this extra knowledge and insight on how this works. It all comes from the Dissecting the Digital Dollar work and all the conversations and interviews and surveys that we've done as part of that. But this brings us to the most recent stage of the digital dollar work, the Song Royalties Guide that MMF published at The Great Escape last year. And the work on this is ongoing, which is the way songwriters get paid is very complicated. So we had that slightly complicated revenue share based on consumption share thing to start with, but that's just the start of it. For example, Spotify doesn't actually know what songs are on its system. It knows what recordings are on its system. It has the ISRC, the unique code, the identifier for each recording, because the label and distributor that uploads the track provides all that information. But they don't know precisely what song is in that recording. The track might be called Hello. That doesn't tell us what song is contained within that recording. So Spotify doesn't actually know who to pay. So Spotify has to outsource that work to its licensing partners within the publishing industry. So publishers and collecting societies, and say to them, here's a list of everything that was played by ISRC. You work out what songs relate to that. So songs have their own unique identifier called an ISWC. So you match the ISRC to the ISWC. Once you've done that, we don't know who owns each song. So you then go into your database and see, okay, who owns that ISWC? It's probably co-owned. Who are the co-owners? How is the money split? And then once you've done all of that, you then invoice us for what you're due, we'll pay you the money, you then pay it to the songwriter or the publisher, and that's complicated. Then you throw in the fact that we've decided that a stream is both a mechanical copy and a performance at the same time, which means sometimes, like in the US, one bit of the royalty is being administrated over here and another bit of the royalty is being administrated over there, which is ludicrous. I mean, it's the same song, extra complexity. Then song rights traditionally were managed on a country-by-country basis. Streaming services are global, so sometimes we have intermediaries, which might be another publisher or a collecting society or a copyright hub or an agency. It is super complicated, and I don't expect you to have followed anything I just said in this section. If you want to know more, download the Song Royalties Guide. You can access it from both the MMF and CMU websites. It explains it all in much more detail. But this is a big issue because money is getting lost because of the complexities in knowing what songs have been streamed, knowing who owns those songs, and then all the people who collect and are involved in distributing that money. Money is getting lost to the system. Now, how much money is getting lost to the system? It's pretty uncontroversial to say that about 20% of the money that flows through the system from the streaming services is not going exactly where it should do. It's not being accurately distributed to the owners of the songs that have been streamed. It's either getting lost or it's being shared out based on market share, or it's going to the wrong people. Some people would say a third of the money is not going to the right places. Some people off the record who work in this reckon it could be as much as 50% of the money is not getting to where it should get to. This is a massive issue. Now, this is not a secret, and there are certain entities within the music publishing business, both publishers and collecting societies and copyright hubs, and also sort of, you know, startup businesses who are all trying to deal with these issues and you know, are generally moving things in the right direction, but quite slowly. And it's definitely aware, songwriters and publishers being aware of this. MMF is doing more work on this to try and help people navigate it. It's so freaking complicated. What the response that most songwriters have and most publishers have when they see all of our work on this is, wow, that's insane. I do not know what to do about that because it's so complicated. So MMF is doing a lot more work in this space. But it is definitely worth songwriters being aware of this, because the reason why this matters is, let's say we've got to reslice the digital pie. Let's say more money is being allocated to the song. Brilliant, but not brilliant if a significant portion of that extra money then gets lost in the system and it doesn't actually reach the right songwriters. So I think that what we call the royalty chain problem, the royalty chain issue that's in the Song Royalties Guide, is definitely something that everyone needs to be aware of, even though it will blow your mind.
But that's songwriters. Let's get on to point seven now and talk about the artist's share, which also has some complexities to it because not every artist is the same. We should probably split artists into different groups, like new artists, heritage artists, and session musicians, and consider all of those separately.
Yes, when it comes to how much of the money artists see, we know how much money is being allocated to the recording. That's what the artists share in, but how much do they get of it? And it's a massive it depends, because the money will flow through a label and distributor on its way from the streaming service to the artist. And how much does the label or distributor keep? And it could be literally anything from the label keeping 95% of the money down to a distributor who doesn't keep any of it. So the artist's share could be anywhere between 5 and 100% of the money. It totally depends on the deal. And as you say, when we talk about whether or not artists should be getting more, and lots of artists and their managers think that they should, they would say that the royalties that artists are getting from their record companies, if they're on a sort of traditional record deal, is often a few percent more than what they would have got on a CD. But surely the label's costs and risks are so much lower on a stream versus a CD that rather than the artist royalty on a classic major label deal from more recent decades going from 15% on a CD to 20% on a stream, it should be 25%, 30% on a stream is what some artists would argue. But yeah, I think it is worth distinguishing between new artists and heritage artists, which is to say artists who have signed deals in more recent years that has a specific rate for streaming. And there was an opportunity when that deal was negotiated to try and get a better rate. Because I think that is different from heritage artists who have record deals that predate streaming, that don't talk about streaming, where often the record company has just randomly decided to apply the CD rate from that contract and then add a few percent. Bearing in mind that if that record contract was signed in the 60s and the 70s, the artist rate could have been 5%, which means they may well now be getting 8, 9% on a stream, which seems very unfair. And I think, you know, for new artists, there is an element of, well, when you're negotiating a label partner to work with, there is now more choice for artists. If they have good, savvy management, there are distribution companies you can work with where you get to keep the rights and keep a lot more of the money. There are labels who will now, in the independent sector, work with you on different terms. And even the majors are very slowly starting to negotiate more. Not fast enough for most artists and managers, but there is room for manoeuvre. So it may well be that when it comes to artists signing new deals, that there are enough commercial pressures in the record industry with lots of labels and distributors competing to work with artists that we will, and in fact, we already are seeing a more artist-friendly environment appearing. And as I say, many artists and managers would say it's not happening fast enough, but we are slowly starting to see that happen. But none of that helps the artists who signed their record contracts in 1982. Life of copyright. The label owns the recording for as long as the copyright exists, and they're paying a much, much smaller royalty on streaming. Is there anything we can do about that? And then what about the session musicians? Because generally the session musician sees zero of streaming income, because session musicians saw zero of money that came in from selling CDs. And we took the CD model and then we built streaming on the back of it. But here's another comparison with radio. If we think about what happens in the radio world, when money comes in from radio, what happens in most countries is that the money that comes in is split 50-50. Half of it goes to the copyright owner, which would often be a record company. And then the other half is shared out between all the performers who appear on the record, both the main artists, but also the session musicians. Why does that happen with radio? Well, it happens because of a thing in copyright law called performer equitable remuneration, which is a performer right that sits in law that says that when the performing rights of the copyright, we've talked about the difference between mechanical rights and performing rights earlier, when the performing rights, or what the record industry these days annoyingly call the neighbouring rights of the copyright, are exploited, then this ER system, as we call it, applies. And so industry standard rates kick in, and half the money goes to the copyright owner and half of the money goes to the performers, including the session musicians. And so some people have said, well, could we not have an ER type system for streaming as well? Isn't streaming a bit like radio? Did we not agree that a stream exploits the mechanical rights, but also the performing rights? Well, hang on a second. If the performing rights are being exploited, why isn't ER being paid? Now, the record companies would say streaming is not radio. It's fundamentally different. There's a copyright technicality where we say actually it's not the traditional performing rights being exploited on stream. It's a thing called making available, and ER doesn't apply to making available. There are arguments on the label's side, but there are plenty of musicians who think that maybe having ER on streams would be a way of ensuring certainly that heritage artists who are on terrible royalties on their old deals get a better rate, and session musicians would also pay. So there are plenty of people who think that there should be some sort of ER on streams as well as radio. But that brings us to point number 8.
Yes, because while applying equitable remuneration to streams sounds good, it's another thing that would be very complicated.
Yeah, applying ER to streams would throw up a number of questions that would need to be answered. First of all, how much of the pie are we allocating to ER to get paid directly to artists and the session musicians? So with radio, it's a 50-50 split. But if you want to be sort of nerdy about it in copyright terms, we're saying that a stream is mechanical rights and performing rights. It's only the performing rights where ER applies. So are we now saying it's 50% of 50%, so therefore 25%? And then presumably that would only apply to the recording allocation. So now it's 25% of 55%. It's getting complicated, isn't it? So all of that would have to be agreed. There's also the issue that ER works slightly differently in different countries. So, for example, who is obliged to make sure the artist gets paid? How does the money flow through the system? It works differently from country to country. Also, ER currently goes through the collective licensing system, which means that a lot of artists in the UK, for example, if they're due ER from Australia, the Australian Collecting Society would actually collect the money and then pass it to PPL in the UK, who would then pay the artist. But we know that when money starts flowing through all the collecting societies around the world, there are issues with that. And again, money gets lost in the system. Sometimes multiple fees are being charged. So there are potentially issues with having ER on streams. Plus, if you are a DIY artist putting out your music through a TuneCore type service where you get 100% of the recording allocation, you would now have to share some of that money with your session musicians. Maybe you should, maybe you shouldn't. Plus, of course, some collecting society, possibly two collecting societies, are going to take a commission. So actually, you're worse off. So there are pros and cons of applying ER to streaming. It's not as quite as simple as saying, right, we'll let PPL get involved and then the artist will get their ER and it's all fixed. So there needs to be more consideration on, okay, if we are to apply ER to streams, quite how would that work? Who would be collecting the money? How do we overcome the issues of money moving around collecting societies around the world? Is it that the collecting societies do a deal with the streaming service and get their own direct funnel of money? Or is it that the labels are still doing the deal, but then they're obliged to pass a portion of the money onto us? All of these things need to be agreed. And really, we need a global solution to this. And historically, ER has been set up and worked differently on a country-by-country basis. So there are some significant challenges there to cross. And it may be that in terms of helping artists and indeed session musicians, there are other things we could be doing other than ER. So, for example, when it comes to new artists doing new deals, making sure that managers understand all the different options that are out there when they're working with labels and distributors, which hopefully means that we get a very competitive marketplace so that better deals are on the table. When it comes to heritage artists on legacy contracts, can we be campaigning to get record companies, particularly the majors, to be giving legacy artists parity on royalties with artists who've signed deals in the last 10 years. There's a thing in the copyright directive in Europe called the contract adjustment mechanism. We don't quite know whether that would apply to music, but it possibly would. And then on the session musician side, there is that whole thing of maybe the record industry should just do a better job of paying its session musicians a better rate up front, because one of the reasons why session musicians are so reliant on things like ER income from radio is because often the fees they get up front are very low. And in the 2000s, when the record industry was in disarray, those fees just got cut and cut and cut. So ER does seem like a good solution, and I'm not saying that it isn't, but there are some challenges with ER, and there may be some other things that we could be doing to help artists get a bigger cut, a fairer cut, really, is what we're interested in, of the streaming money as it comes in.
Talking of other ways we could fix things, we've been through a lot of very complicated stuff there, but one thing that people bring up a lot that seems very simple is user-centric royalty distribution, which would change the way the £10 a month you're putting into Spotify is distributed out, making it go to just the artists you played rather than being split up among everyone as it currently is. And that does seem like quite a quick, easy fix to sort out a lot of these issues, although it probably wouldn't have as big an impact as a lot of people seem to think it would. But that doesn't mean it's not an attractive option.
Yeah, user-centric royalty distribution. If you don't quite understand what that is, we did talk about it in quite some detail relatively recently on Setlist, because last year Deezer launched a campaign trying to persuade the record industry, particularly in France, to go over to a user-centric system for royalty distribution. So basically that whole thing that I talked about at the start of this week's Setlist, how the money gets divided up each month. So the current question is, of all the streaming by all the premium subscribers in the UK last month, what percentage was for this track? And then we work that out, we have an allocation, we share the revenue. Whereas if user-centric, rather than looking at the consumption across the entirety of the Spotify or Deezer or Amazon or whatever user base, we would do the maths on a user-by-user basis. So Spotify would basically say, we got £10 off Chris for his subscription. Of all the tracks Chris streamed last month, what percentage were this track? And my money would get divided up between the tracks that I listen to and then the artists and labels and songwriters and publishers involved in that music. And the reason why user-centric would make a difference is because on the streaming services, you have some users who stream hours and hours and hours of music every single day, and you have other users who only stream a few hours a month. And to an extent, the group who are only streaming a few hours a month are subsidising the artists and songwriters and labels and publishers liked by the people who are streaming 12 hours a day every single day. So the shift to user-centric would change the way the money gets shared out. Now, quite what that actually means in terms of the money that different labels and publishers and artists and songwriters receive is up for debate. Various people have crunched figures on this. So Deezer say they have crunched the figures because they support this, that the superstar artists would be losers under a user-centric system. So would urban music, and so would English language music in non-English speaking countries. So in France, the winners of this would be more niche alternative genres, middle-level artists, and artists who make music in the French language. So we would see a slight redistribution of the money from the superstars and the big global urban acts down to more niche genres in the middle. And, you know, on one level, the superstars don't need all that money. You know, the big urban artists, the global artists, they're making enough money, thank you very much. Maybe it's a good idea to just switch the way we do the maths to the benefit of more middle-level, niche, alternative artists. That said, having looked at some of the studies into this, I think it probably wouldn't have as dramatic an impact as some people think. It's not that overnight everybody would see their streaming earnings radically change. I think also it's not quite as simple as saying all the losers would be at the top of the hierarchy who already have enough money and all the winners would be at the middle. I think there would also be some redistribution of money in the middle, so that within the middle level there would be some people who've just about found a way of making a decent living out of streaming and suddenly they aren't, to the benefit of some other people in the middle level. So, you know, I don't think it's quite the panacea that some people think that it is. That said, I think there are still arguments for why user-centric is attractive. Partly it makes some of the ways that certain people have found to scam the system. Again, we've talked about that before on Setlist. It arguably deals with some of the scams that are skewing with all of this. Also, I do think that most subscribers to Spotify, Apple, Amazon, etc. assume that that is what happens. You know, they assume that the £10 they put in the system is being shared out between the artists and songwriters whose music they consume. So probably that's what subscribers think is already happening, and maybe that alone is enough for saying, well, maybe that is what should happen.
Yeah, maybe there is an argument that what people think is happening to their money should be what is happening. And I think, I mean, like you say, it's an attractive option, and if you know that your money is going to who you listen to, then you're going to feel better about that. Whereas the example people use is that, you know, it doesn't matter how niche and anti-mainstream your tastes are, you will always be subsidising pick big name artists that you don't like here. So Ed Sheeran, people often say in that circumstance, you know, whatever you listen to on Spotify each month, a big chunk of your money is going to Ed Sheeran because Ed Sheeran takes up a big percentage of all the streams on Spotify every month. Or you could say Drake. Drake is maybe even a better example, because Drake's obviously so big on streaming, a lot of your money each month will go to Drake.
Yeah, and perhaps if people felt that their money was genuinely going to the artists and songwriters whose music they enjoy, then they may be less against the idea of it going up a pound a month. So maybe by going to user-centric, it would justify why now's the time to put the prices up. Who knows? Anyway, we're at the end of our 10 points. We have one more thing that I want to say, and this is another really important point.
Yes, point number 10. Bad music rights data makes fixing these things so much harder.
I'm always wary of bringing things back to the music rights data problem, but there are so many of these issues that would be so much easier to solve if we just had decent music rights data, if there was an easy way for a streaming service to access a system that would tell them that if this is the ISRC attached to a recording, these are the performers who appear on that recording, this is the song by ISWC, we know exactly which song it is, these are the writers on the song, these are the publishers on the song, these are the companies and the societies that represent these rights in each country, all of that in one database that we could access, everybody could access it. There was an agreement across the world on this. We don't have one matching of an ISRC and ISWC in Latin America that disagrees with one in France, that disagrees with one in Australia. We don't have one database that tells us that this songwriter has 52% of a song and another database saying that they have 68% of the same song. If we could just get all of that done, it would address so many things. It would make the idea of having ER on streams much more realistic. It would address many of the issues around how songwriters get paid on the royalty chains, which could be resulting in a significant sum of songwriters' money not even getting through the system, which means that even if we reslice the digital pie, that might not help songwriters in anything like the degree to which it should. It also empowers particularly songwriters because there shouldn't be a compulsory license covering streaming, which there is in the US, and there isn't in plenty of other countries, but there kind of is, because we have the issue, because Spotify doesn't know what songs are on its system, let alone who wrote those songs. It means that songwriters can't really, even if theoretically under copyright law they can, songwriters can't really pull their songs out of the system. Because if you say to Spotify, you can't stream my songs anymore, Spotify would rightly say, well, we don't know which recordings contain your songs. You know, it's very difficult for us to press a button and to pull all your songs out of the system. And even if you're in a country where copyright law in theory does give you that power, it's a power that you're not realistically able to use because of really bad music rights data. And if we had really good music rights data, songwriters could say, right, that's it. I don't agree with the model. I think my music has more value than it's currently getting. So all my songs are coming off the streaming services. And actually, if a songwriter, or certainly if many songwriters did that, do you know who would panic first? It wouldn't actually be the streaming services or the users of the streaming services. It would be the record companies. Because if you remove your songs, what you're actually doing is you're removing their recordings. And then the record companies are like, oh, you can't do that because that's going to really impact us. And there's your opportunity to say to the record companies, well, we think that we should get a better rate and we need to all get around the table and negotiate this. But this isn't possible because of the music rights data problem. It's another massive problem that is so mind-blowing. If any one songwriter or publisher or artist or label, it's hard to know what you would do to solve it. But it is so linked into everything else that's happening here. So, you know, when artists and songwriters are demanding a bigger cut of the money, to an extent, it also means sorting out the royalty chain issue on the song side, and it means sorting out the data issue. And that shouldn't be for artists and songwriters themselves to solve. That is for the music industry to solve. But artists and songwriters, through their organisations, should be saying to the music industry, you need to sort out the royalty chains. You need to sort out music rights data because this is having a negative impact on our ability to write the songs and record the tracks, without which there ain't no music industry. There ain't no record companies. There ain't no music publishers. There are no music business podcasts. None of that could happen without the music. So yeah, that would be number 10. Sort out music rights data.
So that brings us to the end of our 10-point list of reasons they are all wrong about streaming. If you want to get into this deeper, there is the Dissecting the Digital Dollar book and the various additional guides in that project that we have produced for the MMF.
Yeah, the big one is the Dissecting the Digital Dollar book. There's actually a brand new edition of that about to come out. So I've spent the last few months updating it with things like the European Copyright Directive, the Music Modernization Act, Deezer's user-centric campaign. So there's a brand new version coming out imminently. And if you go to cmuinsights.com/digital dollar, we'll link to that from the podcast notes. There's a little form that you can fill out and then we'll send you an email alert as soon as that book is available, the brand new version for you to buy it. So if you sign up to that on the CMU website. You'll get an email very, very soon, and then you can go and get the bang up-to-date, brand-new version of the Dissecting Digital Dollar book.
So, yeah, if you are interested in getting more into this stuff, then, yeah, sign up to get that email. There's also the lockdown webinars. We'll put links to all of these things, and there are various things that Chris mentioned over the course of this episode. Put lots of links into the show notes, so go to setlistpodcast.com to access those. But that is the end of this week's show. You can subscribe to receive more episodes automatically every single week, and you absolutely should do that. But as I say, that's it now. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.